Lobsang learned a lot. He learned that every room has at least four corners. He learned that the sweepers started work when the sky was light enough to see the dust and continued until sunset. As a master, Lutse was kind enough. He would always point out those bits that Lobsang had not done properly. After the initial anger and the taunting of his former classmates, Lobsang found that the work had a certain charm. Days drifted past under his broom, until, almost with an audible click in his brain, he decided that enough was enough. He finished his section of passageway, and found Lutse dreamily pushing his brush along a terrace. "Sweeper?"
"Yes, lad?"
"What is it you are trying to tell me?"
"I'm sorry."
"I didn't expect to become a sweeper. You're Lutse. I expected to be apprenticed to, well, to the hero."
"You did?"
Lutse scratched his beard.
"Oh, dear. Damn. Yes, I can see the problem. You should have said. Why didn't you say? I don't really do that sort of thing any more."
"You don't? All that playing with history, running about, unsettling people? No, not really. I was never quite certain we should be doing it, to be honest. No, sweeping is good enough for me. There's something real about a nice clean floor."
"This is a test, isn't it?" said Lobsang coldly.
"Oh, yes. I mean, I understand how it works. The master makes the pupil do all the menial jobs, and then it turns out that really the pupil is learning things of great value. And I don't think I'm learning anything, really, except that people are pretty messy and inconsiderate."
"Not a bad lesson all the same," said Lutse. "Is it not written? Hard work never did anybody any harm."
"Where is this written, Lutse?" said Lobsang, thoroughly exasperated. The sweeper brightened up.
"Ah," he said, "perhaps the pupil is ready to learn. Then you don't wish to know the way of the sweeper? You wish to learn instead the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite."
"Who?"
"We have swept. Well, let's go into the gardens, for is it not written it does you good to get out into the fresh air?"
"Is it?" said Lobsang, still bewildered. Lutse pulled a small tattered notebook out of his pocket.
"In here it is," he said. "I should know."
Tick.
Lutse patiently adjusted a tiny mirror to redirect sunlight more favourably on one of the bonsai mountains. He hummed tunelessly under his breath. Lobsang, sitting cross-legged on the stones, carefully turned the yellowing pages of the ancient notebook on which was written in faded ink, "The Way of Mrs. Cosmopolite."
"Well," said Lutse,
"the way has an answer for everything, does it?"
"Yes."
"Then," Lobsang nodded at the little volcano, which was gently smoking,
"how does that work? It's on a saucer."
Lutse stared straight ahead, his lips moving.
"Page 76, I think," he said.
Lobsang turned to the page. "Because," he read.
"Good answer,"
said Lutse, gently caressing a minute crag with a camel hair brush.
"Just because, master, no reason."
"Reason? What reason can a mountain have? And as you accumulate years, you will learn that most answers boil down eventually to because."
Lobsang said nothing. The Book of the Way was giving him problems. What he wanted to say was this. "Lutse, this reads like a book of the sayings of an old lady. It's the sort of thing old ladies say. What kind of koan is, 'It won't get better if you pick at it,' or 'Eat it up, it'll make your hair curly,' or 'Everything comes to he who waits'? This is stuff you get in Hogswatch crackers."
"Really?"
said Lutse, still apparently engrossed in a mountain.
"I didn't say anything."
"Oh, I thought you did. Do you miss Ankh more pork?"
"Yes, I didn't have to sweep floors there."
"Were you a good thief?"
"I was a fantastic thief."
A breeze blew a scent of cherry blossom. Just once, thought Lutse, it would be nice to pick cherries.
"I have been to Ankh more pork,"
he said, straightening up and moving on to the next mountain.
"You have seen the visitors we get here?"
"Yes," said Lobsang. "Everyone laughs at them."
"Really?"
Lutse raised his eyebrows.
"When they have trekked thousands of miles seeking the truth?"
"But did not Wen say that if the truth is anywhere, it is everywhere?" said Lobsang.
"Well done. I see you've learnt something at least. But one day it seemed to me that everyone else had decided that wisdom can only be found a long way off. So I went to Ankh-Morpork. They were all coming here, so it seemed only fair."
"Seeking enlightenment?"
"No, the wise man does not seek enlightenment. He waits for it. So while I was waiting, it occurred to me that seeking perplexity might be more fun," said Lutze. "After all, enlightenment begins where perplexity ends. And I found perplexity. And a kind of enlightenment, too. I had not been there 5 minutes, for example, when some men in an alley tried to enlighten me of what little I possessed, giving me a valuable lesson in the ridiculousness of material things."
"But why Ankh-Morpork?" said Lobsang.
"Look in the back of the book," said Lutze.
There was a yellow, crackling scrap of paper tucked in there. The boy unfolded it.
"Oh, this is just a bit of the almanac," he said. "It's very popular there."
"Yes, a seeker after wisdom left it here."
"It's just got the phases of the moon on this page."
"Other side," said the sweeper.
Lobsang turned the paper over.
"It's just an advert from the Ankh-Morpork Guild of Merchants," he said. "Ankh-Morpork has everything."
He stared at the smiling Lutze.
"And you thought that—" "Ah, I am old and simple and understand," said the sweeper, "whereas you are young and complicated. Didn't Wen see portents in the swirl of gruel in his bowl, and then in flight of birds? This was actually written. I mean, flights of birds are quite complex, but these were words. And after a lifetime of searching, I saw at last the opening of the way, my way."
"And you went all the way to Ankh-Morpork," said Lobsang weakly.
"And I fetched up, calm of mind but empty of pocket, in Quirm Street," said the sweeper, smiling serenely at the recollection, "and espied a sign in a window saying, 'Rooms to rent.' Thus I met Mrs. Cosmopolite, who opened the door when I knocked, and then when I hesitated, not being sure of the language, she said, 'I haven't got all day, you know.' Almost to a word, one of the sayings of Wen. Instantly I knew that I had found what I was seeking. During the days I washed dishes in an eating-house for 20 pence a day, and all the scraps I could take away. And in the evenings I helped Mrs. Cosmopolite clean the house and listen carefully to her conversation. She was a natural sweeper, with a good rhythmical motion, and had bottomless wisdom. Within the first 2 days, she uttered to me the actual words said by Wen upon understanding the true nature of time. It was when I asked for a reduced rate, because, of course, I did not sleep in a bed, and she said, 'I was not born yesterday, Mr. Tse.' Astonishing! And she could never have seen the sacred texts."
Lobsang's face was a carefully drawn picture. "I was not born yesterday," he said.
"Ah, yes, of course. As a novice you would not have got that far," said Lutze. "It was when he fell asleep in a cave, and in a dream saw time appear to him, and show him that the universe is recreated from second to second, endlessly, with the past just a memory. And he stepped out from the cave into the truly new world, and said, 'I was not born yesterday.'"
"Oh, yes," said Lobsang. "But—"
"Ah, Mrs. Cosmopolite," said Lutze, his eyes misting over. "What a woman for keeping things clean! If she were a sweeper here, no one would be allowed to walk on the floor. Her house! So amazing a palace! New sheets every other week, and cook! Just to taste her beans baked upon the toast, a man would give up a cycle of the universe." Said Lobsang. "I stayed for 3 months, sweeping her house as is fitting for a pupil, and then I returned here, my way clear before me."
"And these stories about you?"
"Oh, all true, most of them. A bit of exaggeration, but mostly true."
"The one about the citadel in Muntab and the Pash and the fishbone?"
"Oh, yes."
"But how did you get in, where half a dozen trained and armed men couldn't even—"
"I'm a little man and I carry a broom," said Lut Sey simply. "Everyone has some mess that needs clearing up. What harm is a man with a broom?"
"What? And that was it?"
"Well, the rest was a matter of cookery, really. The Pash was not a good man, but he was a glutton for his fish pie."
"No martial arts?" said Lobsang.
"Oh, always a last resort. History needs shepherds, not butchers."
"Do you know Oki Doki?"
"Just a lot of bunny hops. Shiitake. If I wanted to thrust my hand into hot sand, I would go to the seaside. Upsy daisy. A waste of good bricks. No kando. You made that one up. Tung pee. Bad-tempered flower arranging. Snarfu. And for cutting wood it is better to use an axe," said Lutse. "No, violence is the resort of the violent. In most tight corners a broomstick suffices."
"Only most, eh?" said Lobsang, not trying to hide the sarcasm.
"Oh, I see. You wish to face me in the dojo. For it's a very old truth. When the pupil can beat the master, there is nothing the master cannot tell him, because the apprenticeship is ended. You want to learn?"
"Ah, I knew there was something to learn."
Lutse stood up.
"Why you?" he said. "Why here? Why now? There is a time and a place for everything. Why this time and this place? If I take you to the dojo, you will return what you stole from me. Now."
He looked down at the teak table where he worked on his mountains. The little shovel was there. A few cherry blossom petals fluttered to the ground.
"I see," he said. "You are that fast. I did not see you."
Lobsang said nothing.
"It is a small and worthless thing," said Lutse. "Why did you take it, please?"
"To see if I could. I was bored."
"Ah, we shall see if we can make life more interesting for you, then. No wonder you are bored when you can already slice time like that."
Lutse turned the little shovel over and over in his hand.
"Very fast," he said.
He leaned down and blew the petals away from a tiny glacier.
"You slice time as fast as a 10th gym, and as yet barely trained. You must have been a great thief. And now, oh dear, I shall have to face you in the dojo."
"No, there is no need," said Lobsang, because now Lutse looked frightened and humiliated and somehow smaller and brittle-boned.
"I insist," said the old man. "Let us get it done now, for it is written, there is no time like the present, which is Mrs. Cosmopolite's most profound understanding."
He sighed and looked up at the giant statue of Wen.
"Look at him," he said. "He was a lad, eh? Completely blissed out on the universe. Saw the past and future as one living person, and wrote the books of history to tell how the story should go. We can't imagine what those eyes saw, and he never raised a hand to any man in his life."
"Look, I really don't want to—"
"And you've looked at the other statues?" said Lutse, as if he'd completely forgotten about the dojo.
Distractedly, Lobsang followed his gaze. Up on the raised stone platform that ran the whole length of the gardens were hundreds of smaller statues, mostly carved of wood, all of them painted in garish colours. Figures with more eyes than legs, more tails than teeth, monstrous amalgamations of fish and squid and tiger and parsnip. things put together as if the creator of the universe had tipped out his box of spare parts and stuck them together, things painted pink and orange and purple and gold, looked down over the valley.
"Oh, the Dlang," Lobsang began.
"Demons, that's one word for them," said the sweeper. "The abbot called them the enemies of mind. Wen wrote a scroll about them, you know, and he said that was the worst."
He pointed to a little hooded grey shape, which looked out of place amongst the festival of wild extremities.
"Doesn't look very dangerous," said Lobsang.
"Look, sweeper, I don't want to—"
"They can be very dangerous, things that don't look dangerous," said Lutse.
"Not looking dangerous is what makes them dangerous, for it is written you can't tell a book by its cover."
"Lutse, I really don't want to fight you."
"Oh, your tutors will tell you that the discipline of a martial art enables you to slice time, and that's true as far as it goes," said Lutse, apparently not listening. "But so can sweeping, as perhaps you have found. Always find the perfect moment," Wen said. "People just seem so keen on using it to kick other people on the back of the neck."
"But it wasn't a challenge. I just wanted you to show me,
and I shall. Come on. I made a bargain, I must keep it. Old fool that I am."
The nearest dojo was the dojo of the 10th Jim. It was empty except for two monks blurring as they danced across the mat and wrapped time around themselves. Lutse had been right, Lobsang knew. Time was a resource. You could learn to let it move fast or slow, so that a monk could walk easily through a crowd and yet be moving so fast that no one could see him. Or he could stand still for a few seconds and watch the sun and moon chase one another across a flickering sky. He could meditate for a day in a minute. Here in the valley, a day lasted forever. The blurred fighters became a couple of hesitant monks when they saw Lutse. He bowed.
"I beg the use of this dojo for a short period while my apprentice teaches me the folly of old age," he said.
"I really didn't mean—" Lobsang began, but Lutse elbowed him in the ribs. The monks gave the old man a nervous look.
"It's yours, Lutse," said one of them.
They hurried out, almost tripping over their own feet as they looked back.
"Time and its control is what we should teach here," said Lutse, watching them go. "The martial arts are an aid, that is all they are. At least, that's all they were meant to be. Even out in the world, a well-trained person may perceive in the fray how flexible time may be. Here, we can build on that. Compress time, stretch time, hold the moment. Punching people's kidneys out through their nose is only a foolish byproduct."
Lutse took down a razor-edged pika sword from the rack and handed it to the shocked boy.
"You've seen one of these before. They're not really for novices, but you show promise."
Yes, sweeper, but know how to use it?
I'm good at the practice ones, but they're just made of—"
"Take it, then, and attack me."
There was a rustling noise above them. Lobsang looked up and saw monks pouring into the observation gallery above the dojo. There were some very senior ones amongst them. News gets around quickly in a little world.
"Rule two," said Lutse, "is never refuse a weapon."
He took a few steps back.
"In your own time, boy."
Lobsang wielded the curved sword uncertainly.
"Well," said Lutse, "I can't just—" "Is this the dojo of the 10th Jim?" said Lutse. "Why, mercy me, I do believe it is. That means there are no rules, doesn't it? Any weapon, any strategy, anything is allowed. Do you understand? Are you stupid?"
"But I can't just kill someone because they've asked me to."
"Why not? What happened to Mr. Manners?"
"But you are holding a deadly weapon. You are facing an unarmed man in a pose of submission. Are you frightened?"
"Yes. Yes, I am."
"Good. That's lesson three," said Lutse quietly. "See how much you're learning already? Wipe the smile off your face, have I? All right. Put the sword on the rack, and take a dakka stick. The most you can do with that is bruise my old bones."
"I would prefer it if you wore the protective padding."
"You're that good with the stick, are you?"
"I'm very fast."
"Then, if you don't fight right now, I shall wrest it from you and break it over your head,"
said Lu Tse, drawing back.
"Ready? The only defence is to attack well, I'm told."
Lob Sang raised the stick in reluctant salute. Lu Tse folded his hands and, as Lob Sang danced towards him, closed his eyes and smiled to himself. Lob Sang raised the stick and hesitated. Lu Tse was grinning. Rule 2, Rule 3. What had been Rule 1? Always remember Rule 1.
Lu Tse!
The abbot's chief acolyte arrived panting in the doorway, waving urgently. Lu Tse opened one eye and then the other one, and then winked at Lob Sang.
"Narrow escape there, eh?"
he said. He turned to the acolyte.
"Yes, exalted sir. You must come immediately, and all monks who are cleared for a tour in the world, to the Mandala Hall, now!"
There was a scuffling in the gallery, and several monks pushed their way out through the crowd.
"Oh, excitement," said Lu Tse,
taking the stick from Lob Sang's unresisting hands and putting it back into the rack. The hall was emptying fast. Around the whole of Oi Dong, gongs were being banged frantically.
"What's happening?" said Lob Sang as the last of the monks surged past. "I dare say we shall soon be told," said Lu Tse,
starting to roll himself a cigarette.
"Hadn't we better hurry? Everyone's going."
The sound of flapping sandals died away in the distance.
"Nothing seems to be on fire," said Lu Tse calmly. "Besides, if we wait a little, then by the time we get there, everyone will have stopped shouting, and perhaps they'll be making some sense. Let us take the clock path. The display is particularly fine at this time of day."
But
it is written, "You've got to learn to walk before you can run," said Lu Tse,
putting his broom over his shoulder.
"Mrs. Cosmopolite again? Amazing woman. Dusted like a demon, too."
The clock path wound out from the main complex, up through the terraced gardens, and then rejoined the wider path as it tunnelled into the cliff wall. Novices always asked why it was called the clock path, since there was no sign of a clock anywhere. More gongs started to bang, but they were muffled by the greenery. Lob Sang heard running feet up on the main path. Down here, humming birds flickered from flower to flower, oblivious to any excitement.
"I wonder what the time is," said Lu Tse, who was walking ahead.
"Everything is a test." Lob Sang glanced around at the flower bed.
9:15, he said. "Oh? And how do you know that?"
"The field marigold is open, the red sandwort is opening, the purple bindweed is closed, and the yellow goatsbeard is closing," said Lob Sang.
"You worked out the floral clock all by yourself?"
"Yes, it's obvious."
"Really? What time is it when the white water lily opens?"
6:00.
"You came to look?"
"Yes. You planted this garden, did you?"
"One of my little efforts."
"It's beautiful."
"It's not very accurate in the small hours. There aren't too many night-blooming plants that grow well up here. They open for the moths, you know."
"It's how time wants to be measured," said Lob Sang.
"Really? Of course I'm not an expert," said Lu Tse.
He pinched out the end of his cigarette and stuck it behind his ear.
"Oh, well, let's keep going. Everyone may have stopped arguing at cross-purposes by now. How do you feel about going through the Mandala Hall again?"
"Oh, I'll be fine. I'd just forgotten about it, that's all."
"Really? And you'd never seen it before, too. But time plays funny tricks on us all. Why, I once..."
Lu Tse stopped and stared at the apprentice.
"Are you all right?" he said. "You've gone pale."
Lob Sang grimaced and shook his head.
"Something felt odd," he said.
He waved a hand vaguely in the direction of the lowlands, spread out in a blue and grey pattern on the horizon. "Something over there." The glass clock. The great glass house, and here, where it shouldn't be, the glass clock. It was barely here. It showed up as shimmering lines in the air, as if it was possible to capture the sparkle of light off a shiny surface without the surface itself. Everything here was transparent. Delicate chairs, tables, vases of flowers. And now he realized
that glass was not a word to use here. Crystal might be better, or ice. The thin, flawless ice you sometimes got after a sharp frost. Everything was visible only by its edges. He could make out staircases through distant walls. Above and below and to every side, the glass rooms went on forever. And yet, it was all familiar. It felt like home. Sound filled the glass rooms. It streamed away in clear, sharp notes, like the tones made by a wet finger around a wineglass rim. There was movement, too, a haze in the air beyond the transparent walls, shifting and wavering and watching him.
"How can it come from over there, and how do you mean, odd?"
said the voice of Lutse. Lobsang blinked. This was the odd place, the one right here, the rigid and unbending world. And then the feeling passed and faded.
"Just odd,
for a moment," he mumbled. There was dampness on his cheek. He raised his hand and touched wetness.
"It's that rancid yak butter they put in the tea. I've always said so," said Lutse. "Mrs. Cosmopolite's never..." "Now that is unusual," he said, looking up.
"What? What?" said Lobsang, looking blankly at his wet fingertips and then up at the cloudless sky.
"A procrastinator going over speed."
He shifted position.
"Can't you feel it?"
"I can't hear anything," said Lobsang.
"Not here. Feel. Coming up through your sandals. Oops! There goes another one. And another. You can't feel it. That's old 66. They've never got it properly balanced. We'll hear them in a minute. Oh, dear, look at their flowers. Do look at their flowers."
Lobsang turned. The ice plants were opening. The field sow thistle was closing.
"Time leak," said Lutse. "Hark at that. You can hear them now, eh? They're dumping time randomly. Come on."
According to the second scroll of When the Eternally Surprised, when the Eternally Surprised sawed the first procrastinator from the trunk of a wham-wham tree, carved certain symbols on it, fitted it with a bronze spindle, and summoned the apprentice Clodpool.
"Ah, very nice, master," said Clodpool. "A prayer wheel, yes?"
"No, this is nothing like as complex," said Wen. "It merely stores and moves time."
"That's simple, eh?"
"And now I shall test it," said Wen.
He gave it a half turn with his hand.
"Ah, very nice, master," said Clodpool. "A prayer wheel, yes?"
"No, this is nothing like as complex," said Wen. "It merely stores and moves time."
"That's simple, eh?"
"And now I shall test it," said Wen.
He moved it a little less this time.
"That's simple, eh?"
"And now I shall test it," said Wen.
This time he twisted it gently to and fro.
That's simple, pull, eh, simple, eh?"
said Clodpool.
"And I have tested it," said Wen.
"It worked, master?"
"Yes, I think so."
Wen stood up.
"Give me the rope that you used to carry the firewood, and, yes, a pit from one of those cherries you picked yesterday."
He wound the frayed rope around the cylinder and tossed the pit onto a patch of mud. Clodpool jumped out of the way.
"See those mountains?" said Wen, tugging the rope.
The cylinder spun and balanced there, humming gently.
"Oh, yes, master,"
said Clodpool obediently. There was practically nothing up here but mountains. There were so many that sometimes they were impossible to see, because they got in the way.
"How much time does stone need?" said Wen. "Or the deep sea? We shall move it."
He placed his left hand just above the spinning blur,
"to where it is needed."
He looked down at the cherry pit. His lips moved silently, as though he was working through some complex puzzle. Then he pointed his right hand at the pit.
"Stand back," he said,
and gently let a finger touch the cylinder. There was no sound except the crack of the air as it moved aside and a hiss of steam from the mud. Wen looked up at the new tree and smiled.
"I did say you should stand back," he said.
I shall get down now, then, shall I?"
said a voice among the blossom-laden branches.
"But carefully," said Wen,
and sighed as Clodpool crashed down in a shower of petals.
"There will always be cherry blossom here," he said.
Lutse hitched up his robe and scurried back down the path. Lobsang ran after him. A high-pitched whine seemed to be coming out of the rocks. The sweeper skidded at the carp pond, which was now erupting in strange waves, and headed down a shady track alongside a stream. Red ibises erupted into flight. He stopped and threw himself flat on the paving slabs.
"Get down, now!"
But Lobsang was already headlong. He heard something pass overhead with a plangent sound. He looked back and saw the last ibis tumbling in the air, shedding feathers surrounded by a halo of pale blue light. It squawked and vanished with a pop. Not vanished entirely. An egg followed the same trajectory for a few seconds and then smashed on the stones.
"Random time! Come on, come on!"
shouted Lutse. He scrambled to his feet again, headed towards an ornamental grill in the cliff face ahead of them, and with surprising strength wrenched it out of the wall.
"It's a bit of a drop, but if you roll when you land, you'll be okay," he said, lowering himself into the hole. "Where does it go to?" "The procrastinators, of course."
"But novices aren't allowed in there on pain of death."
"That's a coincidence," said Lutse,
lowering himself to the tips of his fingers.
"Because death is what awaits you if you stay out there, too."
He dropped into the darkness. A moment later there was an unenlightened curse from below. Lobsang climbed in, hung by his fingertips, dropped and rolled when he hit the floor.
"Well done," said Lutse in the gloom. "When in doubt, choose to live. This way."
The passageway opened into a wide corridor. The noise here was shattering. Something mechanical was in agony. There was a crump, and, a few moments later, a babble of voices. Several dozen monks, wearing thick cork hats as well as their traditional robes, came running round the corner. Most of them were yelling. A few of the brighter ones were saving their breath in order to cover the ground more quickly. Lutse grabbed one of them, who tried to struggle free.
"Let me go! What's happening? Just get out of here before they all go!"
The monk shook himself free and sped after the rest of them. Lutse bent down, picked up a fallen cork helmet, and solemnly handed it to Lobsang.
"Health and safety at work," he said. "Very important."
"Will it protect me?" said Lobsang, putting it on.
"Not really. But when they find your head, it may be recognisable. When we get into the hall, don't touch anything."
Lobsang had been expecting some vaulted, magnificent structure. People talked about the procrastinator hall as if it was some kind of huge cathedral. But what there was at the end of the passage was a haze of blue smoke. It was only when his eyes became accustomed to the swirling gloom that he saw the nearest cylinder. It was a squat pillar of rock about 3 yards across and 6 yards high. It was spinning so fast that it was a blur. Around it the air flickered with slivers of silver-blue light.
"See, they're dumping! Over here, quick!"
Lobsang ran after Lutse and saw there were hundreds, no, thousands of the cylinders, some of them reaching all the way to the cavern roof. There were still monks in here, running to and from the wells with buckets of water, which flashed into steam when they threw it over the smoking stone bearings at the base of the cylinders.
"Idiots," the sweeper muttered. He cupped his hands and shouted, "Where is the overseer?"
Lobsang pointed down to the edge of a wooden podium built onto the wall of the hall. There was a rotting cork hat there, and a pair of ancient sandals. In between was a pile of grey dust.
"Poor fellow," said Lutse. "A full 50,000 years in one jolt, I'd say."
He glared at the scurrying monks again.
"Will you lot stop and come here? I ain't going to ask you twice."
Several of them swept the sweat out of their eyes and trotted towards the podium, relieved to hear any kind of order, while behind them the procrastinators screamed.
"Right," said Lutse, as they were joined by more and more. "Now listen to me. This is just a surge cascade. You've all heard of them. We can deal with it. We just have to cross-link futures and pasts. Fastest ones first."
"Poor Mr. Shoblang already tried that," said a monk.
He nodded at the sad pile.
"Then I want two teams."
Lutse stopped.
"'No, we haven't got time. We'll do it by the soles of our feet, like we used to do. One man to a spinner, just smack the bars when I say. Ready to go when I call the numbers?'
Lutze climbed onto the podium and ran his eye over a board covered with wooden bobbins. A red or blue nimbus hovered over each one.
"'What a mess!' he said. "'What a mess!'
"'What do they mean?' said Lobsang. Lutze's hands hovered over the bobbins.
"'Okay. The red-tinted ones are winding time out, speeding it up,' he said. "'The blue-tinted ones, they're winding time in, slowing it down. Brightness of the colour, that's how fast they're doing it. Except that now they're all freewheeling because the surge cut them loose, understand?'
"'Loose from what?'
"'From the load. From the world. See up there?'
He waved a hand towards two long racks that ran all the way along the cavern wall. Each one held a row of swivelling shutters, one line blue, one line dark red.
"'The more shutters showing a colour, the more time winding or unwinding. Good lad, got to keep it balanced. And the way we get through this is we couple the spinners up in twos, so that they wind and unwind one another. Cancel themselves out. Poor old Shoblang was trying to put them back into service, I reckon.' "'Can't be done, not during a cascade. "'You've got to let it all fall over "'and then pick up the pieces when it's nice and quiet.'
"'He glanced at the bobbins and then at the crowd of monks.
"'Right, you, 128 to 17, and then 45 to 89. "'Off you go. "'And you, 596 to, let's see, yes, 402.
"'790,' shouted Lobsang, pointed to a bobbin.
"'You what?' "'790.' "'Don't be daft, that's still unwinding, lad. 402 is our man right here. 790 is about to start winding time again. It's still bright blue. It's going to wind. I know it, because—'
The novice's finger moved over the lines of bobbins, hesitated, and pointed to a bobbin on the other side of the board.
"'It's matching speeds with this one.'
Lutze peered.
"'It is written—well, I'll go to the foot of our stairs,' he said. "'They're forming a natural inversion.'
He squinted at Lobsang.
"'You're not the reincarnation of someone, are you? That happens a lot in these parts.'
"'I don't think so. It's just obvious.
A moment ago, you didn't know anything about these.
Yes, yes, but when you see them, it's obvious.
Is it? Is it? All right, then the board's yours, Wonder Boy.'
Lutze stood back.
"'Mine, but I—' "'Get on with it. That is an order.'
For a moment, there was a suggestion of blue light around Lobsang. Lutze wondered how much time he'd folded around himself in that second. Time enough to think, certainly. Then the boy called out half a dozen pairs of numbers. Lutze turned to the monks.
"'Jump to it, boys! Mr. Lobsang has the board. You boys just watch those bearings!'
"'But he's a novice!'
one of the monks began, and stopped and backed away when he saw Lutze's expression.
"'All right, sweeper. All right.'
A moment later there was the sound of jumpers slamming into place. Lobsang called out another set of numbers. While the monks dashed to and fro to the butter pits for grease, Lutze watched the nearest column. It was still spinning fast, but he was sure he could see the carvings. Lobsang ran his eye over the board again and stared up at the rumbling cylinders and then back to the lines of shutters. There wasn't anything written down about all this, Lutze knew. You couldn't teach it in a classroom, although they tried. A good spin driver learned it through the soles of his feet for all the theories that they taught you these days. He'd learn to feel the flows, to see the rows of procrastinators as wells or fountains of time. Old Shoblang had been so good that he'd been able to pull a couple of hours of wasted time from a classroom of bored pupils without their even noticing, and dump it into a busy workshop 1,000 miles away as neat as you pleased. And then there was that trick he used to do with an apple to amaze the apprentices. He'd put it on a pillar next to them, and then flick time at it off one of the small spindles. In an instant, it'd be a collection of small spindly trees before crumbling to dust. "'That's what'll happen to you if you get things wrong,' he'd said. Lutze glanced down at the pile of grey dust under the disintegrating hat as he hurried past. Well, maybe it was the way he'd want to go. A scream of tormented stone made him look up.
"'Keep those bearings greased, you lazy devils!' he yelled, running down the rows. "'And watch those rails! Hands off the splines! We're doing fine!'
As he ran, he kept his eyes on the columns. They were no longer turning randomly. Now they had a purpose.
"'I think you're winning, lad!'
he shouted to the figure on the podium.
"'Yes, but I can't balance it. There's too much time wound up and nowhere to put it.' "'How much?'
"'Almost 40 years.'
Lutse glanced at the shutters. 40 years looked about right, but surely...
"'How much?'
he said.
40, I'm sorry, there's nothing to take it up. No problem, steal it. Shed load, we can always pull it back later. Dump it.
Where?
Find a big patch of sea.
The sweeper pointed to a crude map of the world painted on the wall.
Do you know how to... Can you see how to give it the right spin and direction?
Once again there was the blueness in the air.
Yes, I think so.
Yes, I imagine you do.
In your own time, then.
Lutse shook his head. 40 years? He was worried about 40 years. 40 years was nothing. Apprentice drivers had dumped 50,000 years before now. That was the thing about the sea. It just stayed big and wet. It had always been big and wet. It would always be big and wet. Though maybe fishermen would start to dredge up strange whiskery fish that they'd only ever seen before as fossils. But who cared what happened to a bunch of codfish? The sound changed.
"'What are you doing?'
"'I've found space on number 422. It can take another 40 years. No sense in wasting time. I'm pulling it back now.' There was another change of tone.
"'Got it? I'm sure I've got it!'
Some of the bigger cylinders were already slowing to a halt. Lobsang was moving pegs around the board now, faster than the bewildered Lutse could follow. And overhead the shutters were slamming back, one after another, showing age-blackened wood instead of colour. No one could be that accurate, could they?
"'You're down to months now, lad.'
"'Months!' he shouted.
"'Keep it up! No, blimey, you're down to days! Days! Keep an eye on me!'
The sweeper ran towards the end of the hall, to where the procrastinators were smaller. Time was fine-tuned here, on cylinders of chalk and wood and other short-lived materials. To his amazement, some of them were already slowing. He raced down an aisle of oak columns a few feet high, but even the procrastinators that could wind time in hours and minutes were falling silent. There was a squeaking noise. Beside him, one final little chalk cylinder at the end of a row rattled around on its bearing like a spinning top. Lutse crept towards it, staring at it intently, one hand raised. The squeaking was the only sound now, apart from the occasional clink of cooling bearings.
"'Nearly there!' he called out. "'Slowing down now! Wait for it! Wait for it!'
The chalk procrastinator, no bigger than a reel of cotton, slowed, spun, stopped. On the racks the last two shutters closed. Lutse's hand fell.
"'Now! Kill the board! No one touch a thing!'
For a moment there was dead silence in the hall. The monks watched, holding their breath. This was a timeless moment of perfect balance. Tick. And in that timeless moment the ghost of Mr. Shoblang, to whom the scene was hazy and fuzzy, as though seen through a gauze, said,
"'This is just impossible. Did you see that?'
"'See what?'
said a dark figure behind him. Shoblang turned.
"'Ah!'
he said, and added with sudden certainty,
"'Your death, right?'
"'Yes, I am sorry I am late.'
The spirit formerly known as Shoblang looked down at the pile of dust that represented his worldly habitation for the previous 600 years.
"'So am I,'
he said. He nudged Death in the ribs.
"'Excuse me.'
"'I said, I'm sorry I'm late. Boom, boom.'
"'I beg your pardon.'
You know, sorry I'm late, like dead.
Death nodded.
Oh, I see. It was the boom boom I did not understand.
That was to show it was a joke,
said Shoblang.
Yes. I can see how that would be necessary. In fact, Mr. Shoblang, while you are late, you are also early, boom, boom.
Pardon?
You have died before your time.
Well, yes, I should think so.
Do you have any idea why? It's very unusual.
All I know is that the spinners went wild, and I must have copped a load when one of them went over speed,
said Shoblang.
But hey, what about that kid, eh? Look at the way he's making the buggers dance.
I wish I'd had him training under me. What am I saying? He could give me a few tips.
Death looked around.
To whom do you refer?
That boy, up on the podium. See him?
No, I'm afraid I see no one there.
What? Look, he's right there, plain as the nose on your face. Well, obviously not on your face.
I see the coloured pegs moving.
Well, who do you think is moving them? I mean, you are Death, right? I thought you could see everyone.
Death stared at the dancing bobbins.
Everyone that I should see, he said.
He continued to stare.
Ahem,
said Choblang.
Oh, yes. Where were we?
Look, if I'm too early, then can't you...
Everything that happens stays happened.
What kind of philosophy is that?
The only one that works.
Death took out an hourglass and consulted it.
I see that because of this problem you are not due to reincarnate for 79 years. Do you have anywhere to stay?
Stay? I'm dead. It's not like locking yourself out of your own house, said Choblang, who was beginning to fade.
Perhaps you could be bumped up to an earlier birth.
Choblang vanished. In the timeless moment, Death turned back to stare at the Hall of Spinners. Tick!